This is the Tax Update for January 17, 2008, a special edition. The nighttime for investment fees and trusts. The Supreme Court issues its decision in the Knight case on investment fees and trusts. Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Well, today, the United States Supreme Court issued its decision in the case of Knight versus Commissioner, a case you may have heard referred to under another name, that is the Rudkin Trust versus Commissioner case from the Second Circuit and from the Tax Court. And this particular case deals with the question about whether or not investment advisory fees paid for by a trust are subject to the 2% of AGI limitation under Section 67 of the Code. Now, prior to this case, there had been a split among the circuits, and as well, the Second Circuit came up with a rather draconian position to determine what expenses would be subjected to that 2% limitation. The Supreme Court took on this case, and what they end up doing is essentially taking us back away from the Second Circuit's position, but back to the position that was espoused by the Tax Court, the Fourth Circuit, and the Federal Circuit on which types of expenses are not going to qualify for the deduction, are not going to qualify for the exemption from the 2% limitation. The bad news for this particular taxpayer is their investment fees aren't going to qualify under any of those tests, and the taxpayer lost the case. So we have a case here that was a loss for the taxpayer, but which I think to many of us was considered to be a case that at least got us back to what we thought was the rule in the Tax Court and the other two circuits that had decided it against the taxpayer. It also turns out to be a reversal of the decision in the O'Neill case from the Sixth Circuit that held many years ago, 1993 case, that allowed for a deduction for such expenses, ignoring the 2% limitation based upon the fiduciary standard, the requirement that the fiduciary manage these investments prudently, and because of the legal standard imposed, the Sixth Circuit had allowed the deduction. That particular theory now is out the window, so if you've been relying upon the O'Neill case, you have another set of problems. But let's go ahead and look down this case in its entirety and deal with this particular issue. Now, the 2% limit arises under Section 67A of the Internal Revenue Code, and that basically says all deductions for individuals are subject to the 2% limit if they're not used in computing adjusted gross income or they're not specifically enumerated in Section 67B. So the default treatment for individuals for itemized deductions is they're subject to the 2% limit. Now, a lot of the deductions we're used to that are not subject to that limit, like the medical deductions, which of course has its own 7.5% limit, the deduction for income taxes, charitable contributions, those are specifically listed under Section 67B as items not subject to this. What we discover is those that fall into miscellaneous deductions, most of those fall into miscellaneous deductions, are the ones that are subjected to this 2% limit. Now, Section 67E provides that the rule generally applies to trust, but with the states and trusts with a couple of exceptions here. That there are two sets of exceptions. The second one is very specific. The trust personal exemption's not subject to 2% limit. Well, okay, that makes sense. The trust and estate's personal exemption is out. As well, the income distribution deduction. Those aren't what are in question. What's in question is under 67E1, there is a clause that allows us to get out for other expenses if the deductions are for costs that are paid or incurred in connection with the administration of the estate or trust and which would not have been incurred if the property were not held in such trust or estate. The question becomes, what expenses qualify for exemption under this provision? Now, the dispute had arisen basically over whether or not we could exclude investment advisory fees. That was the big fight that was going on over the years in this particular area. And the question becomes, are those expenses that were allowed to take with the 2%. The test had become, as noted, the first case dealing with this is 1993's case of O'Neill versus Commissioner. The tax court had held that the proper test was whether they were unique, they were expenses that were unique to trust. That is, they weren't of a type commonly incurred by individuals. The tax court held in O'Neill that the investment expenses were of a type that were commonly incurred by individuals. People pay, individuals pay investment fees all the time for managing and for investment advice. So therefore, the investment advisory fees were subject to the 2% limitation. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in 1993 reversed the tax court on O'Neill. The Sixth Circuit held that these expenses were incurred primarily because there was a fiduciary requirement, basically the fiduciary responsibility imposed on the trustee, and that that was a legal exposure that did not exist had they been managing their own individual account. And for that reason, they were incurred essentially in connection with the administration of the estate and wouldn't have been incurred if the property were not held in the estate or trust. Therefore, the Sixth Circuit held such expenses were not subject to the 2% limit. Now, the tax court never adopted that position. And two cases came down the line later that were decided by the Fourth Circuit in Scott versus United States in 2003 and Mellon Bank versus United States, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in 2001. Now, those two courts of appeals both came up with and decided the question was, are these expenses commonly or customarily incurred outside of trust? And those courts held that investment fees were commonly and customarily incurred outside of trust. Therefore, they didn't qualify for this particular test, or they didn't qualify for this exemption, because they failed the two tests of the deductions being paid or incurred in connection with administration of the estate or trust, and which would not have been incurred if the property were not held in such trust or estate. They held that while there may have been with regard to administration of the trust or estate, they're not the sort of expenses that would not have been incurred if it wasn't held in the trust or estate. Now, the Rudkin case came down later, and this went to tax court. The tax court decided against, applied that same test. Are these the type of expenses that are commonly or customarily incurred, or in the tax court's word, are they unique to trusts and estates? The trust appealed the decision, to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit affirmed the tax court's result, but they held to a different standard in terms of how you judge these particular expenses, and they held the question should be decided upon whether those for costs that could not have been incurred by an individual property owner. So they limited the deduction down to a very narrow category that would escape the 2% limitation, because if the expenses of a type that could have been incurred by an individual, could be incurred by an individual, whether or not it is ordinarily customarily incurred by such an individual, it still would be subject to the 2% limitation. Now, the Supreme Court decided to take up that case when the appeal came by. And the Supreme Court is looking at, there is a split in the circuit. There's a Sixth Circuit. Now, that's an old case in O'Neill. The more recent cases had held for no. Those two were consistent from the Fourth and the Federal Circuit. However, the Second Circuit came to the same conclusion, investment fees are not deductible, but their decision, if taken by face value, had much broader implications for allowing virtually no other expenses being not subject to the 2% limitation. In the interim, before this case was decided this past year, the IRS issued proposed regulations. We'll look at those proposed regulations, which are still in proposed form related to 667 and trust and investment fees, in light of this particular decision. Now, the Supreme Court's decision can be summed up by telling both parties, essentially, you both got it wrong in analyzing this case. Or at least, we'll say the government got it partway wrong. Their initial main position, because they were going to adopt the Second Circuit's position, was wrong. The court did adopt the government's fallback position. We should point that out. But the court also then, the court rejected the Second Circuit's analysis and rejected the trust analysis of how these particular situations should have unfolded, how this should be dealt with. Now, the problem with the Second Circuit was the first one that Chief Justice Roberts, writing for a unanimous Supreme Court, took aim at. And here he notes that the Court of Appeal was looking at whether the cost could have been incurred by an individual. He comes out and blatantly states immediately following that observation that this approach flies in the face of statutory language. He notes that the provision at issue asks whether the cost would not have been incurred if the property were not held in trust, not, as the Court of Appeals would have it, where the cost could not have been incurred in such a case. The fact that an individual could not do something is one reason he would not, but is not the only possible reason. Justice Roberts goes on to state that if the Congress had attended the Court of Appeals readings, it easily could have replaced would in the statute with could and presumably would have. The fact it did not adopt this readily available and apparent alternative strongly supports rejecting the Court of Appeals reading. Well, that far through the decision, I presume with that paragraph, if you were the taxpayer, you'd feel good about this. In fact, the court goes on and lectures that the Second Circuit's proposed reading ignores the first clause of Section 67E1, that is, expenses incurred with regard to administration of the estate. The court notes that if the Court of Appeals readings are correct, it is not clear why Congress would have included the statute, the first clause of Section 67E1. If the only costs were fully deductible are those that could not be incurred outside the trust context, that is, could only be incurred by trust, then there would be no reason to place the condition on full deductibility that the cost be paid or incurred with connection with the administration of the trust. We can think of no expense that would be incurred exclusively by a trust, but would nevertheless not be paid or incurred in connection with its administration. But although the court rejected the Second Circuit's view on the how to interpret the statute, it also did not accept the position of the taxpayer. For the taxpayer's position, the opinion comments that the trustee argues the exception of 67E1 established a straightforward causation test. As an aside, what we'll discover quickly is the Supreme Court has no problem with the fact that their opinion is not going to produce a straightforward answer that's just obvious from glancing at a situation that's going to be very easy to apply. The opinion goes on. The proper inquiry, the trustee contends, is whether a particular expense of a particular trust or estate was caused by the fact the property was held in the trust or estate. Investment advisory of fees incurred by a trustee, argument goes, meet this test because these costs are caused by the trustee's obligation to obtain advice on investing trust asset in compliance with the trustee's particular fiduciary duties. Justice Roberts notes openly, we reject this reading as well. The court argues that this test could render all expenses exempt from the 2% limitation. The Chief Justice writes, on the trustee's view, the statute operates only to distinguish costs that are incurred by virtue of a trustee's fiduciary duties from those that are not. But all or nearly all of a trust's expenses are incurred because the trustee has a duty to incur them. Otherwise, there would be no reason for the trust to incur the expense in the first place. And quoting from Bogart and Bogart, The Law of Trust and Trustees, it's noted the payment for expenses must be reasonably necessary to facilitate administration of the trust. The taxpayer attempted to argue this was not the case, that its reading didn't render all costs exempt from the 2% limitation. But the court wasn't impressed with the example the taxpayer gave, where the taxpayer said that expenses for the routine maintenance of real property held by the trust would be subject to the 2% floor. The court notes that such costs would appear to be fully deductible under the trustee's own reading because the trustee is obligated to incur maintenance expenses in light of the fiduciary duty to maintain trust property. That is, the trustee would have to incur those costs. There's a legal obligation to do so, a legal obligation that, I suppose, to borrow from the Sixth Circuit's rulings, would have no negative consequence except for loss of value to a non-fiduciary if an individual fails to keep up their property, the value of the property declines. Now, obviously, you might face some zoning problems eventually, but let's just assume routine costs that would not cause you a legal problem otherwise would be ones that essentially, according to this reading, you know, are the ones the trust is trying to argue would be subject to the 2% limitation. But the court notes the reason you have to pay them is because your fiduciary duty. In fact, you have to comply with the legal standards because of fiduciary duty. So the court's view is everything could be argued to apply because of the fiduciary duty. Therefore, that would render the second clause of Section 67E1 moot. Now, I will note that, in fact, the objection the Fourth Circuit and the Federal Circuit had to the Sixth Circuit's allowance of the expenses under its view was that, in their view, it rendered basically the provisions of Section 67E1 moot, rendered sections moot, which in their view obviously couldn't work either. Fiduciary duty, if it overrides everything, means there was no point in the second clause. The court clarifies its view about the problem with this position to resolve the matter. As it notes, the trustee's formulation of its argument is circular. Trust investment advice fees are caused by the fact property is held by the trust. But the trust investment advice fees are only aptly described as such because the property is held in trust. The statute asks whether such costs would be incurred by an individual if the property were not. Even when there is clearly analogous category of costs would be incurred by individuals, the trustee's reading would exempt most or all fiduciary costs as fully deductible merely because they derive from a trustee's fiduciary duty. Adding the modifier trust to costs that otherwise would be incurred by an individual surely cannot be enough to escape the 2% floor. The opinion goes on and notes that we have to consider, essentially, the court complains that this renders the second clause irrelevant. The Second Circuit's reading renders the first clause irrelevant. The court goes on and essentially is going to grab for one that allows us to consider both clauses, and it finds that in the criteria that the Fourth Circuit, the Federal Circuit, and the tax court applied. The general rule is, the court outlines a general rule in concluding its complaints about the taxpayer's position. It notes the trustee's reading is further undermined by our inclination in construing provisions in which a general statement of policy is qualified by an exception to read the exception narrowly in order to preserve the primary operation of the provision. As we have said, Section 67E sets forth a general rule for purposes of the 2% floor established in Section 67A. For purposes of this section, the adjusted gross income of a state or individual shall be computed in the same manner as in the case of an individual. Now, the trustee's reading, Section 67E1's exception would swallow the general rule, most if not all expenses incurred by a trust be fully deductible. Given that Congress has enacted a general rule, we should not eviscerate that legislative adjustment through an expansive reading of a somewhat ambiguous exception. The court indicates that it believes there is no simple litmus test against which to compare expenses in this area, but says, hey, that's Congress's fault for the way they wrote the statute. That's how Congress wrote it, and it's not unique to the tax law. More to the point, the court notes, the statute by its terms does not establish a straightforward causation test, but rather invites a hypothetical inquiry into the treatment of the property were it held outside a trust. The statute does not ask whether a cost was incurred because the property is held by a trust. It asks whether a particular cost would not have been incurred if the property were not held in such trust. Far from examining the nature of the cost at issue from the perspective of whether it was caused by the trustee's duties, the statute instead looks to the counterfactual question of whether individuals would have incurred such costs in absence of a trust. The Supreme Court adopts the test proposed by the Fourth and Federal Circuits in their cases on this matter. The issue is whether the expenses of a type that would not commonly or customarily be incurred by individuals. The court defends this reading in light of the trust's objections to it. The trustee objects the statutory text does not ask whether expenses are customarily incurred outside of trust, which is true. That's not the way it's worded directly. But the court notes that's a direct import of the language in context. The text requires determining what would happen if a fact were changed. Such an exercise necessarily entails a prediction, and predictions are based on what would customarily or commonly occur. Thus, in asking whether a particular type of cost would have been incurred if the property were held by an individual, Section 67E exempts from the 2% floor only those costs that it would be uncommon or unusual or unlikely for such a hypothetical individual to incur. Now, how do investment fees fare under this test? Now the court goes on to consider that. Of course, the trust has taken the position that these costs were incurred because of the trustee's fiduciary duties under the Connecticut Uniform Prudent Investor Act. The court takes a look at the definition of what is a prudent investor under the terms of the Act. To satisfy this standard, a trustee must invest and manage trust asset as a prudent investor would by considering the purpose, terms, distributions, and requirements and other circumstances of the trust. The prudent investment standard plainly does not refer to a prudent trustee. It would not be very helpful to explain that a trustee should act as a prudent trustee would. Rather, the standard looks to what a prudent investor with the same investment objectives handling his own affairs would do. That is, a prudent individual investor. The court goes on to note that given that view we just they just gave us of what the prudent investor rule means. And the reading of Section 67E1, it's kind of obvious where the answer is going to come down. As we have no reason to doubt the trustee's claim that a hypothetical prudent investor in his position would have solicited investment advice just as he did. Having accepted all this, it's quite difficult to say investment advisory fees would not have been incurred. That is, it would be unusual and common for such fees to have been incurred if the property were held by an individual investor with the same objectives as a trust in handling his own affairs. In essence, the definition of the prudent investor essentially causes us to lose this if that's the reason we're incurring the expenses. We're incurring the expenses because an individual who is prudently investing their assets would incur the expenses. Now, we can make a bunch of snide comments about the number of people we know who don't invest very prudently, and maybe it's not as common as the court believes for individual investors to be prudent. But ignoring such snide comments, the court's position seems to be rather clear from this, that the prudent investor rule is not going to allow you to take deductions under this term. Now, the court notes the fact that their opinion and that of the Fourth and Federal Circuits denies us a bright line test. But the court essentially says that we have a lot of provisions in the tax law that don't have bright line tests. And Congress wrote the statute this way. We have to work with it. And we work with it in other parts of the tax code, like Section 162 and 212. Interestingly enough, 212 being the area of expenses that we're trying to deduct here. And for those reasons, we can accept this type of ambiguity in our test under the tax law. And to make the point even clearer, the Supreme Court even posits some examples of when you might even be able to deduct investment fees and ignore the 2% of AGI limitation in making that deduction. The court notes, as a Solicitor General concedes, some trust-related investment advisory fees may be fully deductible if an investment advisor were to impose a special additional charge applicable only to its fiduciary accounts. There is nothing in the record, however, to suggest that Warfield charged the trustee anything extra or treated the trustee differently than it would have treated an individual with similar objectives because of the trustee's fiduciary obligations. It is conceivable, moreover, that a trust may have an unusual investment objective or may require specialized balancing of the interests of various parties, such that a reasonable comparison with individual investors would be improper. In such a case, the incremental cost of expert advice beyond what would normally be required for the ordinary taxpayer would not be subject to the 2% rule. The court goes on to note, though, that this particular case doesn't meet those facts. Therefore, it's going to be subject to 2% limitation. As noted, the prudent investor standard certainly does not appear to be one you will hang your hat on to get around this 2% limitation on trust clients. As well, those advisors who've continued to deduct these expenses, and that's probably very true for those of you located in the Sixth Circuit, which you had the O'Neill case to hang your hat on and claim these expenses could be deducted without regard to the 2% limitation. Now, you need to be very aware the 2% limitation clearly does apply to investment expenses generally. And you may need to consider advising or discussing with your clients the advisability of amending prior returns that have taken the position that no 2% limitation was involved. Now, we can get to a long discussion about whether or not an amended return is required. I happen to think probably not required, but your duty to discuss the options and the issues and the pros and cons is also fairly clear under Circular 230 and for CPAs under the Statements of Standards of Tax Services, because it has become clear when you're working with them this year that you are aware of an issue on the prior return and you should discuss this matter with them. However, the good news from this case is that the extremely restrictive view the Second Circuit gave us also does not apply. Many commentators were concerned that under that restrictive rule, we could lose a lot of expenses that we customarily deduct without regard to the 2% limitation, could be lost straight out under the Second Circuit's broad reading of what you had to do. You had to show you could not ever have incurred this expense as an individual. If you could, under any odd circumstances, no matter how wild or unusual, the expense would have been subjected to the 2% haircut. Now, on July 27th last year, the IRS issued proposed regulations that had the stated objective of resolving the split in the circuits that the Supreme Court just took on today. The proposed regulations create a uniqueness test under proposed regulations 1.67-4A. Now, in fact, the original decision you're going to find, if you go read the original Rudkin decision from the tax court, it uses that very term of unique expenses to tell you what are not subject to the 2% limitation. However, in this regulation, the tax court the IRS adopted a definition of uniqueness that's reproduced in the materials that the Supreme Court held in a footnote essentially was adopting the Second Circuit's position and taking their test as stated in the Second Circuit. So it would have been an expense that essentially could not have been incurred by an individual. Now, given the Supreme Court's rejection of the Second Circuit analysis as contrary to the statute, I would suspect the IRS would find if they went forward with these regulations and made them final as currently stated without revision, they might have a problem. We need to keep a watch on if these regs move forward, and as these regs move forward, presumably the IRS will go ahead and finalize the project. They may very well have to make changes to Section 1.67-4B in the regulations and change the definition of unique to conform with the definition that we found here for the question of whether they are commonly incurred by an individual or outside the trust context. However, note that those proposed regulations also contain a caveat about bundling fees, and note that you cannot escape the impact of the 2% limitation by bundling what would otherwise be limited 2% expenses, like investment fees, into a more generic trustee management fee or some other fee that may attempt to combine 2% and non-2% items. Under the proposed regulation, a trust would be required to split those out. Note, also, in the Supreme Court's example of potential investment fees that could be deductible, it seemed to give some credence to that position as well, because it told you you might have those special circumstances where you needed investment fees, but only the excess fees, that had split out the uniqueness, the unique cost split out from a bundled fee, would be deductible. That suggests that the uniqueness portion of the reg would sustain is something the Supreme Court agrees with. However, going forward, it does appear that at least the key question of do we get the investment fees has now been answered by the Knight case. Keep in mind, the Knight case is now out there. It is a Supreme Court decision. We have to pay attention to that decision when moving forward and doing our tax returns for this year. It is important that all of our clients understand that the law has now been clarified, and especially if you had previously been relying upon the O'Neill decision, you probably need to have a conversation with your trust clients who have been relying upon O'Neill and tell them the position is going to change from here forward because the Supreme Court has now spoken. This is the special edition of the Tax Update for January 17, 2008. The Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. I suspect the other authors, because there's been a number of commentaries on this on Steve's site, that there will be email commentary in more detail on the Rudkin/Knight decision and its implications from a number of sources, so I'd watch for that. Again, visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices and consider subscribing to their newsletters. This has been the Tax Update.